Imagine standing at the northern entrance of a great city more than 2,500 years ago. The sun is bright and hot. In front of you rises a gate so enormous it seems to touch the sky. Every surface of it glitters with deep blue tiles, and from those tiles emerge rows of animals, fierce lions, powerful bulls, and strange serpentine creatures, all made from fired clay and painted in gold and white. The gate seems alive. It hums with color and power. You are about to enter Babylon, the greatest city on earth. And the man who built this world was named Nebuchadnezzar Roman II. His name is difficult to say and easy to forget, but the world he created was impossible to ignore. Let us go back to the beginning, to understand how one man's ambition turned a city into a legend. To understand Nebuchadnezzar, we first need to understand what came before him. For centuries, the people of Babylonia, a flat, fertile region between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, in what is today the country of Iraq, had lived under the control of the Assyrians. The Assyrians were a fierce and powerful people from the north of Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia is a Greek word meaning land between the rivers, and it refers to this ancient region of the Middle East where some of the world's earliest civilizations began. The Assyrians had dominated the region for generations, and the Babylonians lived under their shadow. Then came Nabopolassar. He was a Chaldean chieftain, a leader of a group of semi-nomadic people who had settled in southern Babylonia. Think of him as a regional leader who had grown tired of being controlled by a distant power, like a local governor who finally decides to throw off the rule of a foreign empire. Nabopolassar managed to do what many had tried and failed to do. He broke free from Assyrian control and founded what historians call the Neo-Babylonian Empire. The word Neo simply means new. It is used to separate this later Babylonian Empire from earlier ones in the same region. The Neo-Babylonian Empire was a fresh start, a new chapter for an ancient city. Nabopolassar was a skilled ruler, but his son would be the one to make Babylon immortal. That son was Nebuchadnezzar Roman II. Even before he became king, Nebuchadnezzar was a proven military commander. His father trusted him to lead armies, and the young prince proved worthy of that trust. His most decisive moment came in the year 605 BCE. The letters BCE stand for Before the Common Era, which is a way of counting years before the year 1 CE, the year traditionally associated with the birth of Jesus Christ. So 605 BCE was more than 600 years before Christ, and more than 2,600 years ago. At a place called Carchemish, in what is now modern Syria, Nebuchadnezzar led the Babylonian army against a combined force of Egyptians and the last remnants of the Assyrian army. The battle was decisive. The Babylonians crushed their enemies so completely that Babylonian control over the entire Near East, the region stretching from the mountains of modern Iran all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, was established in a single day of fighting. The Near East is the term historians use for the region covering modern-day Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and parts of Turkey and Iran. While Nebuchadnezzar was still on campaign, far from home, news arrived that his father Nabopolassar had died. The prince understood immediately that he had to move fast. A throne left empty for too long invites rivals. He made a rapid journey back to Babylon and secured his place as king before any opposition could gather. We know all of this because of remarkable physical evidence that has survived. The Babylonian Chronicles are a series of clay tablets written in a script called cuneiform, a system of writing made by pressing a reed into soft clay, producing wedge-shaped marks. These tablets are primary sources, meaning they are documents created at the time the events happened, not written down later from memory or tradition. One particular tablet, known to scholars as BM 21946, describes Nebuchadnezzar's victory at Carchemish and his hurried return to claim the throne. It is a direct, factual record from his own time. Now the new king faced two great tasks. First, he had to keep his enormous empire under control. Empires in the ancient world were always in danger of falling apart. Subject peoples, those who had been conquered and forced to pay tribute, which meant taxes or goods given to a more powerful ruler, were always looking for chances to rebel. Egypt was still lurking nearby, hoping to reassert its influence over the smaller kingdoms of the region, especially those in the land of Canaan, which included the kingdom of Judah. Second, Nebuchadnezzar had a grand personal vision. He wanted to rebuild Babylon and make it the most glorious city the world had ever seen. He wanted it to be so magnificent that when people looked at it, they would think immediately of the gods and of their king. These two tasks, military control and architectural glory, would define his entire reign. The Kingdom of Judah was a small but strategically important territory on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean. It sat on the land bridge connecting the great powers of Egypt to the southwest and Babylonia to the northeast. Whoever controlled Judah controlled the road between empires. The Judeans, however, were proud and independent people with a deep attachment to their god, their temple, and their land. They did not accept Babylonian control easily. In 597 BCE, the Judean king Jehoiakim, who had been paying tribute to Babylon but secretly negotiating with Egypt, died during a Babylonian siege, and his successor quickly surrendered. Nebuchadnezzar took decisive action. He marched his army to Jerusalem, the Judean capital, captured it, and removed its leadership. He placed his own chosen king, a man named Zedekiah, on the Judean throne. Think of this like a chess move, removing one piece and replacing it with one of your own. He also deported a large number of people to Babylon. The word deport here means to forcibly remove people from their homeland and send them to live elsewhere. Among those taken were the king, members of the royal court, priests, skilled craftsmen, and other important citizens. This was a deliberate strategy. By removing the educated and capable class of people from a conquered land, you weakened that society's ability to organize resistance. But Babylon had not yet finished with Judah. King Zedekiah, the puppet king that Nebuchadnezzar had installed, eventually did the very thing a puppet king should never do. He rebelled. Encouraged by the Egyptians, who were always whispering promises of support they rarely delivered, Zedekiah chose to defy Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar's response was without mercy. In 587 or 586 BCE, scholars debate the exact year, his army surrounded Jerusalem and laid siege to it. A siege is a military tactic where an army surrounds a city and cuts off all food and supplies, waiting for the people inside to starve or surrender. The siege of Jerusalem was long and brutal. Eventually, Nebuchadnezzar's forces broke through the city walls. What followed was devastating. Jerusalem was burned. The royal palace was destroyed. And most significantly, the first temple of Jerusalem, the great temple built by King Solomon, which was the sacred center of Jewish worship and the place where the Israelites believed God himself was present, was completely demolished. Its sacred objects were taken as spoils of war. A second, larger wave of deportations followed. Thousands more Judeans were marched across the desert to Babylon. This event is known as the Babylonian exile or the Babylonian captivity. The word exile means to be forced to live away from your homeland. This event was so important and so traumatic that it shaped Jewish history, religion, and identity in ways that are still felt today. Far from their land, without their temple, the exiled Judeans had to ask themselves the deepest possible questions. Who are we without our holy place? How do we worship when we cannot go to the temple? How do we keep our traditions alive? The answers they developed, focusing more deeply on scripture, prayer, and community, helped transform the religion and laid foundations for the Judaism we recognize today. The Babylonian exile is described in the Hebrew Bible, particularly in the books of 2 Kings, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, and these accounts give us a vivid picture of the suffering and spiritual searching of the exiled people. It is important to pause here and note something fascinating about how history works. When we read the Babylonian Chronicles, Nebuchadnezzar appears as a strong, capable king who suppressed rebellions and maintained order in his empire. His campaigns are described in calm, administrative language as simply the necessary business of imperial rule. But when we read the Hebrew Bible, the same man appears as a terrifying destroyer, an instrument of divine punishment, the king who tore apart a holy nation and dragged its people into slavery. Both descriptions refer to the same man, doing the same things. yet they tell completely different stories. This is one of the most important lessons that history teaches us. Every account is written from a perspective. The same event looks different depending on where you are standing. Neither source is lying, but neither is giving you the complete picture alone. Good historical thinking means reading multiple sources and asking, who wrote this? Why did they write it? And what might they have left out? Now let us turn to the city itself. Because Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar was one of the genuine wonders of the ancient world. An inscription that Nebuchadnezzar left behind reads, simply and proudly, O Babylon, I have made you magnificent. He was not exaggerating. Using the enormous wealth and the labor, much of it forced labor from conquered peoples, that his military campaigns produced, he transformed Babylon into a city of breathtaking scale and beauty. He was, in the truest sense, a builder king. The first thing any visitor to Babylon would have encountered was its walls. Great, towering walls surrounded the city in a double circuit, meaning there were two sets of walls, one inside the other, so that any attacker who managed to break through the first would immediately face a second. The Greek historian Herodotus, who wrote about Babylon perhaps a century after Nebuchadnezzar's time, claimed that the walls were so thick that a chariot pulled by four horses could turn around on top of them. This description is probably an exaggeration. Herodotus was a wonderful storyteller, but not always a careful measurer. But it conveys something real about the impression these walls made on everyone who saw them. They were vast. They were meant to intimidate. They were meant to say, "This city cannot be broken." The most spectacular point of entry into the city was the Isher Gate, and it is worth spending time here because it is one of the few parts of Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon that we can still see today. The gate was named for Isher, the goddess of love and war, a powerful combination that tells you a great deal about how the Babylonians thought about divine power. The gate was covered from base to top in glazed bricks of a deep, brilliant blue, a color that would have stood out dramatically against the brown and sandy landscape of Mesopotamia. Against this blue background, two rows of animals repeated endlessly as you walked through. There were lions, which symbolized Isher herself. There were bulls, representing Adad, the storm god. And there were creatures that looked like a cross between a snake and a dragon, with the body of a large lizard but the head and front legs of a different animal entirely. These were called Mushashu dragons, and they symbolized Marduk, the chief god of Babylon, the divine protector of the city. The gate was not just a security structure. It was a religious experience. It was the beginning of what the Babylonians called the processional way, a grand, paved avenue that led from the northern gate through the heart of the city to the great temple complex. During the most important religious celebration of the Babylonian year, the New Year festival, statues of the gods would be lifted from their shrines, placed on decorated boats or carried in procession, and paraded through the Isher Gate and down the sacred road. Thousands of people would line the way. Music would play. Incense would burn. The king himself would walk in the procession, as both a political leader and a religious figure, renewing his relationship with Marduk and legitimizing his rule for another year. The Isher Gate was excavated, carefully dug up and studied, in the early 20th century by a German archaeologist named Robert Koldwy. Archaeology is the study of the past through physical objects and structures that people left behind. Koldwy and his team recovered thousands of the original glazed bricks, and these were painstakingly reassembled. Today, a magnificent reconstruction of the front section of the Isher Gate stands in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin, Germany. It is one of the most dramatic objects in any museum in the world. A wall of deep blue more than 14 meters high, covered in those gold and white animals, giving modern visitors a direct, physical connection to Nebuchadnezzar's world. It is worth noting, however, that the gate is in Germany, not Iraq. This raises a question that museums and governments debate to this day. Is it right for ancient artifacts to be held in countries far from where they were created? There are people who argue passionately on both sides, and it is a question with no simple answer. At the center of Babylon's religious life, near the processional route, stood the city's great ziggurat. A ziggurat is a type of massive stepped temple tower built in a series of increasingly smaller platforms stacked one on top of the other, like a giant layered cake rising up toward the sky. The design was meant to create a kind of staircase between earth and heaven, a physical symbol of the connection between the human and the divine. Almost every major Mesopotamian city had a ziggurat, because they were the dwelling places of the gods, the sacred mountains in a flat land that had no natural mountains of its own. Babylon's ziggurat was named Edamenenki, a Sumerian word meaning temple of the foundation of heaven and earth. Sumerian was an older language of Mesopotamia, and many religious terms and names had been preserved in it even after it was no longer spoken in daily life, much the way Latin is used in the Catholic Church today, even though nobody speaks Latin as their first language. Edamenenki was enormous. Ancient texts and the physical evidence that remains of its foundation suggest it had 7 levels and rose to a height of approximately 91 meters, roughly as tall as a modern 30-story building. At the very top was a shrine dedicated to Marduk. Nebuchadnezzar did not build this ziggurat from nothing. It had existed in earlier forms for centuries, but he rebuilt it on a grand scale, investing enormous resources in restoring and enlarging it. Now, many scholars believe that this very structure, this enormous stepped tower in the land of Babylonia, built with the forced labor of people from many different nations who spoke many different languages, was the inspiration for one of the most famous stories in the Bible, the Tower of Babel. The story in Genesis 11 describes a time when all people spoke one language and decided to build a tower reaching to heaven in a land called Shinar, which is another name for Babylonia. God, in the story, scatters the people and confuses their languages to prevent them from completing the tower. The similarities between this story and the reality of Edamenenki are striking. Nebuchadnezzar's building projects did use workers from all across his empire, people who spoke dozens of different languages. The ziggurat did sit in Babylonia. It did aim, symbolically and architecturally, to connect earth and heaven. This does not mean the Bible story is simply a historical record of Nebuchadnezzar's construction projects. It means that real events and real places can inspire stories that take on a life of their own, carrying deeper meanings about human pride, divine power, and the limits of ambition. And now we come to the most mysterious and debated part of Nebuchadnezzar's legacy, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. The Hanging Gardens are listed as one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world. The 7 wonders were a list compiled by Greek and Roman writers of what they considered the most extraordinary structures ever built. The Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt is the only one of the 7 that is still standing today. The others, the statue of Zeus at Olympia, the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, the Mausoleum at Halicarnassus, the Colossus of Rhodes, and the Lighthouse of Alexandria, have all been destroyed by time, earthquake, and human action. The Hanging Gardens are unique among all 7 in that their very existence is seriously in doubt. The story, as it has come down to us, is this. Nebuchadnezzar fell in love with and married a princess named Amides, who came from Media, a mountainous kingdom in what is now northwestern Iran. Amides was accustomed to the green, forested hills of her homeland, and she found the flat, dusty plains of Babylonia dry and depressing. She was, in modern terms, homesick. So Nebuchadnezzar, the story says, ordered the construction of an artificial mountain for her, a series of stepped stone terraces, each filled with deep soil and planted with trees, flowering plants, and hanging vines, so that the whole structure appeared from a distance like a green mountain rising from the plain. Water was brought up from the Euphrates River below through an elaborate system of pumps or a device similar to what we now call an Archimedean screw, a helical mechanism that could lift water from a lower level to a higher one by turning. The gardens were so lush and so surprising, greenery cascading downward like a waterfall, that they became famous throughout the ancient world. It is a wonderful story. It is also a story with a very serious problem. No Babylonian source mentions the Hanging Gardens. Not one cuneiform inscription. Not one clay tablet. Nebuchadnezzar was a prolific builder and he left behind many inscriptions proudly listing his construction achievements in exhaustive detail. The Isher Gate is mentioned. The walls are mentioned. Temples and palaces and roads are mentioned. But gardens? Nothing. Furthermore, Herodotus, the Greek historian who did visit Babylon, described its walls and temples with great admiration. He wrote at length about the city, but he never mentioned any hanging gardens. For a structure described as one of the wonders of the world, this silence is very strange. The accounts we do have all come from Greek and Roman writers who lived centuries after Nebuchadnezzar, and none of them claim to have seen the gardens themselves. This mystery led to a fascinating piece of detective work by a scholar named Stephanie Daly, a researcher at Oxford University. She proposed a bold alternative. The hanging gardens were real, but they were not in Babylon. She argued, using textual and archaeological evidence, that the gardens were actually built in Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire, by the Assyrian king Sennacherib, about a century before Nebuchadnezzar. Nineveh is also in Mesopotamia, and archaeological excavations there have found evidence of large, lush garden terraces and a sophisticated system of aqueducts, channels built to carry water over long distances, that matches the ancient descriptions of the hanging gardens remarkably well. Dallas' theory is that later Greek writers confused Babylon with Nineveh, perhaps because both were immensely famous ancient cities in the same region, and in doing so accidentally attached a real Assyrian wonder to the Babylonian king. Her theory is compelling and has been taken seriously by many historians, but it has not been universally accepted. There is no scholarly consensus, meaning no general agreement among experts, about whether the gardens existed in Babylon, existed in Nineveh, or were perhaps a poetic exaggeration that grew over time into a wonder of the world. Why does the legend persist even without solid evidence? Perhaps because it is such a human story. A powerful man, the conqueror of nations, the destroyer of Jerusalem, reduced to building a garden because his wife misses the mountains of home. It makes Nebuchadnezzar, for a moment, not a terrifying king but simply a husband trying to make his wife happy. Stories that reveal the human heart beneath the armor of power tend to survive. Nebuchadnezzar Roman II reigned for 43 years, a remarkably long and stable rule for the ancient world. He built not just monuments but a functioning imperial state, with sophisticated administration, trade networks, and systems of law. Babylon under his rule was a cosmopolitan city, a place where people of many different origins, languages, and traditions lived together, including large communities of exiled Judeans, Egyptians, and people from across the Near East. We know from the Hebrew Bible that some of the exiled Judeans eventually rose to significant positions within the Babylonian court, suggesting that the relationship between conqueror and conquered was not always simple or brutal. But empires have their own mortality. After Nebuchadnezzar died in 562 BCE, a series of weaker rulers followed. Palace intrigues, meaning secret plots and power struggles within the court, destabilized the empire. Just 23 years after the death of the man who had made Babylon magnificent, the city fell to a new power rising from the east. In 539 BCE, the Persian king Cyrus the Great marched into Babylon. Remarkably, Babylon was taken without a major battle. Cyrus presented himself not as a conqueror but as a liberator, a king chosen by Marduk himself to restore order, and many Babylonians accepted this story and welcomed him. One of his first acts was to allow the exiled Judeans to return to their homeland and rebuild their temple, a decision recorded in both Persian records and the Hebrew Bible. Nebuchadnezzar's legacy divides sharply into two streams, and they have flowed separately ever since. In the world of archaeology and history, he is remembered as the Builder King, the man who created the Babylon of legend. The physical evidence of his achievement, the reconstructed Isher Gate, the foundations of his palace, the remains of Edamenike, confirms that his pride in his city was justified. He genuinely created something extraordinary. In the world of religious tradition, in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, he is remembered very differently. He is the destroyer, the proud and cruel king who burned the holy temple and scattered God's people. The Book of Daniel, which contains some of the most vivid descriptions of Nebuchadnezzar, portrays him as a man of terrifying power who was ultimately humbled by God, even describing a mysterious period when the king went mad and lived among animals in the wild for 7 years. There is no Babylonian evidence of this episode at all, and scholars debate whether it is a metaphorical story, a confused memory of another king's behavior, or something else entirely. What is certain is that this portrayal of Nebuchadnezzar as the archetypal tyrant, the proud ruler brought low by divine power, has shaped how billions of people across history have understood his name. This is finally one of the most important things this story teaches us about how we understand the past. Nebuchadnezzar built one of the great cities of the ancient world. He also destroyed one of the most sacred sites in religious history. He was, in the estimation of his own culture, a devoted servant of the gods, a builder and protector of civilization. He was, in the estimation of another culture his armies had shattered, a brutal destroyer. History is rarely the story of simple heroes and villains. It is the story of powerful forces, political, military, cultural, and spiritual, colliding with each other, and the meaning we make of that collision depends on where we stand. The blue tiles of the Isher Gate are still blue, after more than 2,500 years. The animals still stride along its surface, gold and white against that impossible deep blue. They have survived empires and deserts and centuries of silence. If you stand before them in the Pergamon Museum today, you are looking at something Nebuchadnezzar looked at too. That connection across time, that shared experience of beauty and power, is what history, at its best, makes possible. To summarize the key ideas we have covered, Nebuchadnezzar Roman II was the son of Nabopolassar, the founder of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, and he came to power after a decisive military victory at Carchemish in 605 BCE, establishing Babylonian control across the Near East. His campaigns against the Kingdom of Judah, including the destruction of the First Temple in 587 or 586 BCE and the forced deportation of the Judeans to Babylon, were transformative events that profoundly shaped the development of Judaism and left a deep mark on the Hebrew Bible. As a builder, Nebuchadnezzar transformed Babylon into the greatest city of its time, constructing the magnificent Isher Gate and processional way, and rebuilding the great Ziggurat at Amenemhat, which many scholars believe inspired the biblical story of the Tower of Babel. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, supposedly built for his homesick wife, remain historically uncertain. No Babylonian source confirms them, and one scholar has proposed they were actually located in the Assyrian capital of Nineveh. After his death, his empire fell to the Persians in 539 BCE. But his legacy has endured in two different forms, as a brilliant builder king in the historical record, and as a powerful symbol of tyranny and divine judgment in religious tradition. The study of his life reminds us that the same person can appear very differently depending on whose records we read, and that good historical thinking always asks who is telling the story and why.